For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin, brought to you by The Nation magazine. Right now, we're going to do our latest in what we've been calling basketball butterfly effect with basketball savant Arya Shirazi. But we're not doing a butterfly effect this week. Usually, we do a butterfly effect, like what if this person had drafted this person, and you know, what if the wind had blown off somebody's hat right when David Stern was about to speak. I don't know. I just saw Miller's Crossing. Hats in the air are very much on the brain. The question what we're facing today, though, is not a butterfly effect, although you could argue that we could find a lot of butterfly effects over the course of five decades regarding this topic. But the question we want to answer is, why in the blue hell have the New York Knicks not won a title in 50 years? This is New York City. It's the city game. It's the game that made the game. It's where Curtis Blow wrote Basketball. It's the site of some of the most dynamic teams in NBA history. It's just that those dynamic teams kind of curdled up and died in 1973. So what the hell has happened in the last 50 years? How has this town remained titleless when it comes to basketball, of all sports? How has Eli Manning won 2 and the Knicks won 0? It makes no damn sense. So Arya Shirazi, first and foremost, welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation magazine.
Thanks very much, Dave. Looking forward to talking about this.
So 5 decades, Arya. 5 decades and no title for just a team that is iconic. And the thing about it that troubles me, I just want you to start throwing some reasons at me why you think that's the case. But a couple of the things that I just keep thinking about, what's so weird is that it's not that Madison Square Garden has turned into a piece of crap. It's still the world's most famous arena. It's still like you get a buzz when you go in there, unlike any other freaking arena in the country. And you're right on 34th Street. You know, there's still the vibe. So New York still has all of this. And yet the teams have been piss poor. It's like having one of those Bentleys, and instead of using gasoline, you use tab. I'm just riffing here, buddy. Okay, so I'm throwing it to you. 5 decades, no titles. What comes to your mind?
Depression.
You know, sadness about that. You know, for the reasons you talked about, you know, what New York means to basketball and what basketball means to New York. You know, there's a that's incredibly personal to us. And you had said in your intro that, you know, the franchise is really kind of curdled and died since 1973. That is true in the ultimate goal sense, but not, I mean, especially the time when you and I were growing up in New York alongside the Knicks, they were not dead, actually. I mean, they were a big part of city culture for, you know, about a 15-year period, the entire 90s, and then the few years before and after that, or in a more general sense, really, the Patrick Ewing years.
And that's one of the things, and that's one of the things I want to explore with you, and maybe we should just start there before coming up with theories about, you know, NBA stars preferring Miami because of warmer weather. And, you know, it's easy to pin a lot of it on piss poor ownership, particularly Dolan. But Dolan has not exactly been the owner for 50 years. So that's a little too easy. I think we overstate the Ewing years. I mean, when you go through them, he's drafted in 85, gets to the finals in 94. First of all, that's a long time. But second of all, the going doesn't get good until Pat Riley gets there in 91. So that's 6 years into Ewing's career. And remember, those are bigger 6 years back then because he spent 4 years at Georgetown. So it's not the same like today where a guy in his sixth year could become a first-time All-Star. I mean, the expectations were so high for Ewing out of the gate. And the statistics are there. But when you go through the years, it's like, terrible, terrible, terrible. Oh, hey, they hire Rick Pitino. You know, they do a couple of interesting things for a couple of years. Pitino bolts. Terrible, terrible. And then Riley comes in. So Ewing, I mean, you know, he'll always have a place in my heart. But not David Robinson. Not Tim Duncan. Not Kareem. Not a franchise changer. Not Olajuwon, who makes the finals in what, his second year in the league. I mean, so I don't want to, as we have this conversation, I don't want to mistake a blip for a renaissance. That's my only point.
And it's a very, very pertinent point. I agree with just about everything you said. I'm not trying to quibble on language, but Ewing was certainly a franchise changer. He was absolutely a franchise changer, and likely not beyond that as far as lofty adjectives go. But certainly a franchise changer nonetheless. But I actually agree really with your main point. There have been, we recently, when talking about Stephen Curry and about, you know, what if he had slipped to the Knicks and if they had chosen him, what would have happened to the Knicks franchise and Curry's career versus what has happened with him on the Warriors. And we went into many aspects of the Knicks And again, we are, you know, in the Knicks right now in the midst of kind of their sunniest season in a long time. You know, after like a playing 500 ball for about the first month, they've really come on. Brunson is fantastic. Randall's having a great year. The OG Anunoby acquisition has been fabulous so far. So the Knicks look like they're going to be a factor of sorts in the Eastern Conference. And saying that sentence is a triumph in itself, because that has not been said about the Knickerbockers franchise, but only a very few times in the past 20 years or so. So as we had talked about again in the context of the Curry discussion, it's been a long time since the Knicks were solidly and unquestionably in the conversation of trying to chase a title. And that, of course, is the franchise that we were largely following, you know, certainly when we were in high school, whenever that was. you were saying the Ewing years are overstated. I think, you know, Ewing was our superstar. And so, you know, that was, you know, Knicks fans are fiercely defensive of Patrick. And there was a time, especially when all these players were active, that Knicks fans kind of bristled at the suggestion that Ewing was not Olajuwon, or that Ewing was not even Robinson. That was like a point of pride for Knicks fans. And it is true. It was true then, and it's true now that they've been retired for decades. The titles, not only the fact that each of them have a most valuable player award and Patrick does not, but they have rings, multiple rings, both of them. Patrick never was the most valuable player. And I think that's the thing. I think that that being a Knicks fan, you had mentioned the Riley years, which is really, of course, the pinnacle of what the Knicks hope to achieve, is the Pat Riley teams of the 90s centered around Patrick Ewing. And doing battle, fierce battle, with a few different teams that would go on and win championships. Patrick was never a top five player. He was the best center in the East for a long time until Shaquille came along. Mm-hmm. And then for a while he was second. He was the leader of a team, routinely winning 50 plus games, mm-hmm. winning division titles
with Riley,
winning playoff rounds. But he was never a top five player. There were just too many better players playing at that time. He was a top 10 player. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that even when things were good, so much of Knicks history post their two titles in the 70s, has echoes of heartache, winds up with heartache, is because those Ewing teams largely overachieved in many ways.
You just said something really important, because most people would say those Ewing teams underachieved. I think they overachieved because we were overstating how good Ewing was. And we were overstating who he was because he was a star in New York, when if he'd played somewhere else, it might have played out very differently. You know, he could have been the guy who, oh, wow, at Georgetown, we thought he was going to be Bill Russell. And somehow he turned into the greatest jump shooting big man of his time, easily, you have to say that. And someone who wasn't quite the athletic wunderkind that people thought he was going to be coming out of Georgetown. I mean, his knees were just too tough. You know, 4 years of Big East ball then was like, you know, some sort of rough and tumble semi-pro league. People were throwing fists. You know, Ralph Dalton was not messing around. So there, Michael Graham. I mean, so I just think he showed up with some tread on the tires, as it were, that a player today certainly would not. And then that player would be managed in a way that Ewing, you know, all out for John Thompson, you know, was not. But because we got so defensive about Ewing, we elided the fact that the guy needs help. You know, he needed a young Xavier McDaniel. You know what I'm saying? Like Supersonics Xavier McDaniel. That's who he needed. And he never got a player that good in all his time with the Knicks as Supersonic Xavier McDaniel.
As you said earlier, Patrick comes into the league at 22 after four bruising years with the Hoyas. So he comes in heralded, rightly so, as the number one pick. Three national championship appearances in 4 years. One of the greatest college players ever. And so comes in at 22, as you said, not 19. So the clock is ticking right away, in a sense. That might be overstating it a little bit, but, you know, there's not all the time in the world. And I think part of, you know, a large part of the thrill and inevitable agony of being a Knicks fan during that time was that the Knicks were never the team to beat, as I think we've both been agreeing on. The Knicks were the hunters, not the hunted. And there is a, you know, there's a different psychology. There's a different mindset being the hunted or a pursuer. And for years, as we said, spanning across different teams that were at the top of the East that the Knicks were looking to supplant, the Knicks year in and year out, starting with Pitino, but then really, as we've been saying, crystallizing and sustaining under Pat Riley, the Knicks were defeating and or going down in defeat in heroic, bloody fashion to teams that were more talented. That you know, if it is and was a superstars league, we did not have the best superstar. Right. We had a superstar. I think he would have been a star just about whatever team he had gone to. Patrick Ewing was that great. But as I had just said, there were always several superstars, other franchise players that were above Patrick.
Yeah.
So there was a sense of striving, and there was a sense going up against either these more pedigreed or more talented teams every year. It was that sense of always climbing a hill and beating prettier, more talented teams through toughness. And there's a romanticism about that, about being tougher and working harder.
Look at the best-selling book by Chris Herring, Blood in the Garden. I mean, that to me says so much. I interviewed Chris Herring about this, and the first thing I asked him was, how is a book about a team that never won a title a bestseller? You know, this is not some heralded all-time team. But at the same time, he made the point, you know, a lot of it is New York and, you know, the fact that it's New York. And a lot of it is just this incredible, rugged affection that people had for these teams. I mean, these teams were kind of badass. And that's why we like them. And if you're ready to, I'd love to move beyond Riley now. You had Don Nelson briefly, which we've discussed, was just a damn shame that didn't click. Although the legacy of Don Nelson with the Knicks is unleashing Mace in your face, Anthony Mason dribbling the ball up the court and running the break, running the point even. Van Gundy. And then 1999, which another moment that Knicks fans adore, that I think the over-adoration hid the bigger structural problems. Do you want to talk a little bit about 99, that strike shortened year, and what went down?
Sure. As we've just been saying, the Knicks, even at the height of their success in the 90s and anytime afterwards, were never the most talented team, were never the favorite. I think it was the reason they are so adored and fondly remembered by myself and many others, is because the Knicks were going up against these foes and climbing a hill and coming up just short. And the ways in which they came up short, the details would change, but the end result was the same. So there was that sense, again, that sense of beautiful struggle as a Knicks fan, that opened up that hope that next year would be different, but also kind of created an expectation that at the very least, the team was always going to be hardworking and competitive. The Van Gundy years are not to be glossed over. He was really a continuation of Riley, but also, you know, kind of, you know, put his own stamp on the team. Van Gundy was a great coach in the NBA and for the Knicks. And really, the story doesn't end with Riley, as Patrick got older and creakier and was no longer a top 10 player in the league. The Van Gundy years and his system and the players brought in enabled that hopeful championship window to be extended, five or six years after Riley was already in Miami. Actually, yes. And doing playoff battles with the Knicks.
Now we're talking.
You know, and just supporting that sense of being the pursuers as opposed to the team with the target on their back is that since Ewing was drafted in 1985, I can only remember one time that the Knicks went into the playoffs as the number one seed in the East. I haven't looked it up. I might be forgetting a year, but I don't think so. I think only 1993 were they the number one seed. And even then, they certainly were not favored to knock off Chicago.
Were they not in 94 in Jordan's retirement year?
Nope. They weren't.
Who was
they? It was Atlanta. They were in 93, which was the Charles Smith year, which adds again to the extra heartbreak, because not only did Charles miss numerous layups that would have won the game and gone to game seven, but for the first time against a team that was favored, the Knicks had home court advantage. The deciding game and games would have been at the Garden. And that was the only time. I think it's telling that the two times that they have been in the finals since winning it in 1973, one time they were the number two in 94, which I'm sure we'll talk about what went on in 94, but Atlanta was the number one team. And then they were knocked off by Indiana, who wound up having the first of their kind of epic playoff series
real
with
quick,
the Knicks.
The best player on that Atlanta team, would that have been Steve Smith at that point?
Danny Manning. Manning was traded.
The best player on that
Knicks.
Atlanta team was Danny Manning.
Yeah, Neek was traded to the Clippers for Manning when Manning was kind of an all-star forward with the Clippers, and Atlanta, they're coached by Lenny Wilkins, and they were just having a really, really, they were kind of number one, I think, all year. It was, as you said, the Jordan retirement year, and Chicago was still very, very competitive, but weren't on top of the East. Atlanta kind of cruised from start to finish and then made a controversial trade deadline deal, trading Meek for a younger Manning, which didn't turn out. They got the way they hoped, didn't lead them to the finals. They got bounced in the second round, and then Manning bounced.
Wow, bruh. First of all, I got to give you a lot of credit because you've nailed this. They were the number one seed. That was the year of Manning. Very well done. But there were two people on that team who averaged double doubles, neither named Danny Manning. Can you name them?
On the Hawks. Okay, so maybe he wasn't the top gun. No.
He had a great year. I'm staring at it. They're just, he might have even led them in scoring. But I'm just saying there were two other people on the team who averaged double doubles. Can you
Kevin
name
Kevin Willis?
Yes, 19 and 12.
Of course. A
good
human
player, man.
Oh,
good
Kevin
player.
Was really good. And the other was probably a guard. Blaylock?
I'll give you a hint. Jeremy Spoken yesterday.
It is Mookie.
Yes, Mookie Blaylock. Yeah. I know you said Blaylock before I sang, but I didn't want to lose the opportunity for a solo.
No, I'm glad that you sang.
Thank you. I thought you were going to be like Jeremy Lin.
Yeah, I really like both of those guys, and I think I stand by my earlier assertion that Manning was the best player on that team.
Yeah,
I think 93 Manning's better than those guys. 94 Manning.
It's so funny though, because you recall that, and I don't recall that at all. But 19.
So anyway, so the Knicks, you know, kind of capitalize on that and go to the finals. Obviously, losing in typically heartbreaking fashion to the Rockets and Ewing's kind of arch nemesis. Akeem. 99, we were talking about. I finally meandered back to that. 99 is the most typical. Of course, it's the strike. So it was a super weird year. By the time the playoffs started, it felt like, you know, players were just kind of getting into shape. So the standings were certainly more arbitrary going into the postseason than they ever would have been in a normal regular season, the sample size being a lot smaller. And so, of course, the Knicks were the number eight that went to the finals in an incredibly ragtag, lovable run to the championship. Again, because it was a curtailed season, the Knicks were not the typical number eight.
Yeah.
And if it had been a full 82, I'm thinking that they probably wouldn't have been number eight. They might not have gotten home court in the first round, but they were not a number eight squad. Then again, they were not a team that anybody was pegging, shortened season or not, making a finals run. It was still Van Gundy. But Ewing, it was really even more hobbled than he had been.
Remember, the run came because Ewing sprained both his wrists, right?
Oh, so Patrick was inactive for that run?
For the run, and then it was, we'll do some fact-checking real quick, but Patrick inactive for the run. Pretty clear about, pretty sure about that.
So we're talking Allen Houston. Latrell being given a second chance on the East Coast and instantly becoming a Garden favorite, of course. Larry Johnson and Marcus Camby, which, as I say that team, I was like, oh, I love that team, really fun. But part of the love and the fondness of memory comes from the fact that that team is not really a finals team. Especially without even a an aged Ewing, even taking him out of the equation. So it was so unlikely that they would march through the postseason where ultimately the dream died. And I think they weren't that competitive against the Spurs in the finals. But until that point, it was incredibly fun.
Speaking of fun, do you know who was on that 1999 team?
For the Knicks?
Yeah, who would be? I mean, I guess I'm at.
I just mentioned a few guys. Then there's Kurt Thomas.
Yeah,
and then it was Warden Childs, right?
And
am I forgetting anybody big?
No, not Dudley? Big. Just fun. Rick Brunson.
Rick.
So Jalen's poppy. How cool is that?
Remember that?
He
was barely an NBA player.
Barely. True.
His son's a lot better.
His son is I've said so many hellaciously stupid things about basketball over the years, not the least of which is what I just said about Ewing. He was with the team, not the leading scorer by any stretch, but was with the team through that playoff run and then tore his Achilles right before the finals and didn't play against the Spurs. That's the story.
Okay.
So
I thought he had been involved at one during the run.
The run was all about Camby and Sprewell with some Allen Houston on the side, right?
No, I think Houston was the main guy, was probably the leading scorer. I think it was really Sprewell, Houston. Camby was great at that time. And as I think you've talked about on an earlier episode, Larry Johnson, a groundbound Larry Johnson, old before his time, really contributing
so much,
being a factor on that team, outsides of what it looked like he would have been able to accomplish. So again, that unlikely run kind of creates in New Yorkers, creates almost a false sense of optimism and a false sense of where the Knicks are as a team relative to other finals contenders. And I think they make a couple of more playoff appearances with behind that Houston Sprewell core before inevitably Sprewell and Houston as your best players isn't good enough.
Yeah.
And that's really where the murkiness starts, and save for a couple of very brief flashes of something better, remains until pretty much this year.
Yeah.
So that is, it's really the two stories. It is the overachieving Knicks team, as you said, playing a style of ball that wasn't innovative because it was the Detroit Pistons had really brought that kind of physical, punishing, dirty aspect, a relentless defensive play. They had shown that could win championships. The Knicks inherited that and had the perfect group of guys to become the team that did that and were successful at it.
And then, finish.
No, right. And so that's like the first half, you know, those teams that kind of, in my mind, maximized their talent and their disparate parts to become a finals contender every year, falling short at various points each year, going into a team that just suffered from two decades of terrible management. And of course, Dolan is such a cartoon.
Well, there you go. There you go. I wanted to, because I think this is the point where we have to talk about what I think of as the original sin for the last 25 years and the toxicity of James Dolan. Ewing was done. He was making something like $18 million a year. He was in the last year of his contract. It would have been so easy for them to bid him farewell, say, you know, he's just a non-factor. So they'd be like, sign wherever you want. We get $18 million off of our books. And we could start, you know, rebuilding the program here on a firm basis. What do they do instead? They trade Patrick to Seattle for Vin Baker. Now, Vin Baker in New York.
Did Vin play with the Knicks?
Vin, yeah, man, dude, hit the Googles while I'm saying this. Absolutely, I did. He played with the Knicks. And that's when he got into his big substance abuse problems, which they were oddly always very careful to say was alcohol related and not drug related. Maybe it was just alcohol. It's just interesting that that's rare. I mean, that's like, you know, Chris Mullen. It's like, it's just the booze. When, as you and I know, booze can be much more harmful. Okay.
Just look at Vin Baker.
Just look at Vin Baker. And from Hartford. Now, so then the Knicks are tied to something like 5 years of Vin Baker with all his issues. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry to jump in. Yes, it is the, and again, I actually, it's all coming back. But I guess I just erased the whole Vin Baker in the garden out of my mind. That's just a step too traumatic for my sensibilities. I knew Patrick had gone to Seattle, but the particulars had been erased. Along with that decision is the decision to give a max contract to Allen Houston.
That's right.
Which is big, which is a huge move in the transition into irrelevancy, mm-hmm. embarrassing irrelevancy, because Houston is, you're the Knicks. Houston is your best player. And after that groovy run to the finals in 99, it goes back to the reality that if Houston is your best player, or if Sprewell is your best player and Allen's your leading scorer, you're really not good enough. Mm-hmm. Your ceiling's low. But he's still, they kind of have no other options. And it's the mindset of you don't let your best player leave and be great somewhere else.
And God, and this is the Dolan mentality. God forbid we have to rebuild in New York. Because you got to be a cha-cha-cha.
So Houston gets a max contract, meaning he's occupying a huge chunk of the Knicks salary cap. And he's still Allen Houston. And then in short order, he becomes Allen Houston who needs microfracture surgery. So it goes from seriously overpaying a player who's not that good to seriously overpaying a player who's not playing. And that actually is kind of indicative of the decision-making of the Knicks that they just keep wading deeper into, and it's harder for them to emerge. And really the state of their team, they actually, the first rebound move they make, and feel free to cut in at any time.
Well, I was thinking about Peter. I was thinking about Peter Vesey, who has me blocked on all social media, calling Allen Houston Albatross Houston.
Yeah,
like as about as sensitive as his medical Bill Cartwright lines back when we had Big Bill in the middle.
I never thought Vesey deserved to call his column Hoop du jour.
No, that should have been somebody else.
Just another bald guy cracking wise.
No, a guy who was known for trying to get into fights when All-Star break, when they would do the journalists would play full court, and he was apparently a cheap shot artist. Just
not surprising in the slightest.
No, not surprising in the slightest. But so we can elide over, if you like, just the horrors of like Jerome James and his big contract and
the, I have nothing to say about that.
The really upsetting Stephon Marbury years, because those should
that is their pivot move.
Yeah.
That's their pivot move. Van Gundy quits. He knows things ain't getting better. So he leaves, kind of in a way, the last vestiges of when they were good. And they swing a trade with Phoenix to get Stephon Marbury, Brooklyn-born, Coney Island Steph, all-star Steph. Steph, who's been put up big numbers in Minnesota, in New Jersey, and in Phoenix. So there is excitement. It's New York, so it's undue excitement to an extent.
Exactly.
But Stephon Marbury wasn't just, you know, local boy comes home. Stephon Marbury at the time was kind of acknowledged as a level below Allen Iverson. Mm-hmm. And that's when Iverson was at the height of his powers. Mm-hmm. It's easy to forget that now. And in reality, maybe it was two and a half levels below Iverson. But Marbury was a player who was really highly regarded, who put up very big numbers on teams that sometimes made the playoffs, and was an exciting player to watch. And by the time, you know, and so when he comes to the Knicks, again, he is from New York, and he's young, and he's an all-star, and this is kind of the most exciting acquisition since Ewing a while ago. And
totally agree.
I think, you know, it
had to be there.
It's all hazy now, but I think maybe they make a fairly inconsequential playoff appearance under Marbury. But of course, it doesn't amount to anything larger than that. And actually, it's really the beginning of a fairly rapid descent for Marbury's production career and kind of mental health
and standing. I mean, his place with the
reputation, for sure.
Reputation, him and Isaiah and Dolan, you know, running just basically a sexual harassment firm called Dolan Thomas and Marbury. Not to make light of it, it's really screwed up. But I know for a lot at that time for me, and that's when I was living in D.C. and Jordan. In D.C. and after Jordan, Gilbert Arenas. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing being a Knicks fan? Like, it cracked me. Like them, like the Thomas, Marbury, Dolan, Anuka Brown, Sanders stuff. I mean, it was just so gross.
It was very, very grim. To add insult to injury, to multiple injuries, the Suns are able to pawn off Marbury and his big contract on the Knicks to be able to pretty much give Marbury's contract to Steve Nash.
Right.
Who promptly wins two MVPs, takes Phoenix to the top of the league for a few years, and in a way changes the way NBA offense is played. So that's just another painful aspect of a move which at first seemed like it could yield a positive direction.
But then for a second, the Knicks were fun and I was pulled back in. And this is so Knicks. What I'm about to say is as Knicks as thinking that all you have to do is give Larry Brown $50 million or Phil Jackson a gajillion dollars and everything will automatically heal itself. You know, just these splat, like always trying to win the back page, not the standings. And the thing that when I was pulled back was the team with Amari Stoudemire, Wilson Chandler, a young Danilo Gallinari, Raymond Felton. I like this team. And then there's all this rumbling about Carmelo is going to be a free agent at the end of the year. So what do the Knicks do? Can they wait six freaking months and sign Carmelo to the free agent deal for where everybody knows he wants to be and keep some of these other pieces? Or do they trade Chandler, Gallinari, who other good pieces too, for Carmelo? Because that's the way I remember it. Is that the wrong way to remember it?
As we've said, Knicks teams and Knicks fans are actually most in their element when they're not the most talented, but have a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. And are a defense running scrappy squad working together to maximize the most out of their parts to make a successful whole. That's who they were when the goal was a championship. And you were talking about kind of that fleeting team post Marbury, pre Carmelo, that again was exciting and hardworking and were knocking off teams that were more talented than they were. And so, you know, and so there was briefly kind of excitement in the garden and excitement around the Knicks. Again, I believe Mike Woodson is the coach at that time. And you talked about the Carmelo deal, but it isn't just the Knicks. It would be easy to say, well, it's New York, you know, so everything, you know, of course, you know, they have to go for the big splash, the big home run. Yes, and in New York, everything is magnified. And at its most shrill and desperate, things have the ability to get dumber in New York than in many other places. Because of those expectations and the huge shadow of the media. But even with a fun team looking to make a little bit of playoff noise, that's not enough. That's not good enough for what the Knicks are. So now that we're talking about something that occurred a long time ago, it's pretty much universal among Knicks fans and basketball talkers that ultimately Carmelo Anthony at the Knicks was a failure, a disappointment. Yeah. You and I have talked about that in a few different conversations. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I think we're talking 2011, Melo has only been having great years in Denver, winning scoring titles, having a scrappy team looking to win 48 games on the hard work, sweat, and grit of Wilson Chandler, Raymond Felton, and Gallinari is not going to satisfy Knicks fans beyond a year or Knicks ownership. So, I think it would have been rare at the time to find anyone who was against acquiring Carmelo. If you had even named the players, it would have been, of course, you know, for some, you know, above average starters, of course, you know, of course you get Carmelo, especially because, as you said, just added Amare Stoudemire in the last, coming off Phoenix in the last 1 or 2 years of him still being an all-star.
I love Amare because he was big enough for New York. You know what I'm saying? Like it seemed like he was glowing from the attention as far and not shrinking, but you know, his knees are his knees. And Amare was all about that quick jump dunk. And once he lost that, it was, you know, just a matter of time.
Right. But even a healthy Amare, which the Knicks had for maybe a year and a half, a healthy Stoudemire with some very, very good other players, it still is not good enough. That's right. A second round team in 2010, 2011, 2012. So you know, in a way, Anthony comes available. They had missed on LeBron, despite your optimism about that.
And you remember that?
Yeah, I remember. I was hoping you were right. You weren't. And so in a way, it was, you know, I mean, we've even talked about the parallel careers of LeBron and Carmelo and really being linked until they weren't linked anymore, until LeBron didn't have to be linked to Carmelo anymore. But for a long time, they were. Mm-hmm. And so you miss out on LeBron. Melo's kind of, again, the naturally, you know, like a natural
silver medal.
Fall, exactly. And it's those moves. So it isn't even acquiring Marbury is, you know, was not a stupid move by management. Acquiring Carmelo, yes, did not work out like anybody hoped, but also not an asinine move, a move that actually makes sense. You can be for it or against it, but, you know, it has, you know, like a potentially higher reward.
Mm-hmm.
Is Carmelo at that time leading you to a championship? Never came close to that, but, you know, it's kind of everything else. I think it is the savior mentality.
Yes,
that Dolan has had.
Mike D'Antoni, Larry Brown,
Mike D'Antoni, Isaiah, Phil Jackson. You know, that kind of that savior figure who is going to come in, and there's got to be a recipe. There's got to be a formula. And we ain't got it. We don't know what it is, but other teams are winning championships. So somebody has it.
Yeah.
So if we can just bring in the person who has it, then we'll have it. And that really, it's that defines the Knicks pretty much until they bring in Tom Thibodeau. And of course, the story is not over. You know, it's nice to make it to the second round when you haven't made it to the playoffs 8 years in a row. That's great. And I'm not diminishing that. And I'm not trying to be snarky at all. But I'm saying, you know, the Knicks are having a really good year. And, you know, and look like they're going to be able to sustain above average play. And I still don't see any way that they make it past the second round.
Me neither.
Regardless of who they play, there's just too many better teams in the East. It's not an indictment on them. It, you know, it's really cool to be where they are after being where they were for so long.
I ask you, can New York, I love this team, by the way, partly because I've been a Brunson guy since Nova. And seeing a team where Brunson can just cook, like those small stretches when he was on the Mavericks with Luka on the bench, or that one playoff game when Luka didn't play and Brunson dropped like 40 and everyone was like, who is that guy? And I remember being like, that was the goddamn NCAA player of the year is who that guy was, with two titles. Put some respect on his name. They're always like second round draft pick, Jalen Brunson. It's like, this guy's the best of the best at the collegiate level. So I still get worked up about it. So Brunson, a team built around Brunson. There's been a lot in the media where Becky Hammon and Candace Parker were basically like, well, you can only go so far with him as your lead. And to me, it's like, be patient with it. Please don't trade for Donovan Mitchell. You know, I'd rather you trade for Donovan McNabb. Like, don't have something where you have two little dudes in the backcourt, both ball dominant. You know, please. But I don't know. I mean, the recipe, now that Embiid seems very ensconced in Philly and very happy, and now that Giannis, although things got a little testy with Adrian Griffin being fired and Giannis being like, wasn't me. I don't know. If it's all about trying to get some big splash guy, I mean, there might have to be just a different path, like the Nuggets took.
I agree with you, and I agree with Becky. I agree with you in yes, don't. When you have finally built a team or the beginnings of a team and are starting to rebuild a culture that's been so rotten for so long and now doesn't feel like it is, then I agree. Don't fuck up the chemistry to get a bigger name in there. See, give this team a playoff run. I'm not saying don't make a couple of roster improvements at the deadline if you can, but don't do anything kind of earth-shaking just to make a big move when you finally have a team that seems to be winning games consistently. I agree with the naysayers in that ultimately I don't see a team led by Jalen Brunson making it to the finals. Does that mean Jalen can't be the starting point guard and team leader and still an all-star on a team that makes a run to be the best in the East? Sure. But yes, I think that they will have to upgrade. You know, I agree. Don't bring in another ball dominant small guy in the Donovan Mitchell mode. You know, maybe upgrade in the front court to try to take that next step. But I do think I look at this Knicks team right now as a really nice story and a team that's got a nice thing and a good vibe going. I don't, as currently constructed, look at them as a serious, serious team in the East. There are five or six teams that are just better.
Well, the at times imbecilic, but sometimes perceptive radio host Colin Cowherd says, don't confuse a good story with a good team. And that I thought was kind of smart, because we do get it, like Jeremy Lin, you know, we do get enraptured in these stories and we're not looking at it honestly. So as we wrap up the show, oh, please.
The story is the Knicks don't suck.
Yes.
That's the story. So that's real.
And Jalen Brunson's got that dog in him. That's the story too.
Yeah. This, you know, I remember, you know, I haven't been able to afford to go to a game at Madison Square Garden since about 1987. But I remember Nick, you know, a couple of years, not that long ago, when it seemed like the crowd at Madison Square Garden was just waiting until that point where they could break out in a Fire Isaiah chant. That was the most spirited that crowd was going to get. And often that chant, that opportunity came in the first quarter. Mm. And that was a depressing state of a team. It was depressing to watch a team where that was kind of, you know, the one uniting force among those watching. The story is that the Knicks have a playoff team. So that is real.
Only the second time this century they've been at least 10 games over 500 at this point in the season.
So there is no reason to diminish that and keep it going. I mean, they're getting better every month. So, you know, prove my ass wrong. Beat teams that I think are better.
Exactly. Ananobi has changed the mathematics on that, to me, common sense statement that there's no way they get past the second round. I do think Ananobi at least scrambles that math a little bit.
If they save a trade, a deadline deal, save bringing in a DeJounte Murray, who I'm a huge fan of, or another starter, you know, somebody who put DiVincenzo back to the bench, for example. And Dante's having a really good year for the Knicks.
Great year.
But bumping up in that regard, if a move like that does not happen, I will be absolutely shocked if the Knicks make the conference finals. I will be shocked. Whatever four or five teams they would run into in any second round matchup, the Knicks, as currently constructed, beating those teams in a seven game series, I will be very, very impressed. And I'll be very, very surprised. But
I'm saying is that I agree with you. But all I'm saying is that Anunoby, to me, scrambles it from no way with, you know, Barrett and Quickly to now being like, could he bother some of these wings just enough? You know, Giannis doesn't like playing him. Tatum doesn't like playing him. These are better teams. But could he bother them just enough to free things up for the other guys? Could Randle actually have a bomb-ass playoff series? He's been so mediocre in the playoffs. We know what Jaylen can do. I'm not saying they're going to make the conference finals. I am not a Strunz. But I'm ready to have a conversation in a way I wasn't before about how they could and what the path could be.
One thing that certainly helps the Knicks' prospects of making a playoff run, as well as any other team in the East that's looking to have similar success, is the Bucks hiring Doc Rivers. Because that definitely takes Milwaukee out of doing anything.
Wow. That's a strong take, Shiraz.
You know, that effect, you know.
That's a championship coach you're talking about.
Yeah, he had one year where he had the best team and he didn't fuck it up. And I thought at the time when I was young and beautiful, I thought that he was truly the architect of that Celtics team. That, like, having Doc, you know, Thibodeau as, you know, the scowling defensive mastermind, but Doc as the architect in all ways. Doc has proven himself so kind of incompetent, at times inept, with different teams, different really, really good teams since that year, that my opinion about him has completely changed. And as I say, I have no idea what went on with Adrian Griffin, you know, no idea really what's happening in Milwaukee. It's really a drag to get canned when you're 30 and 13. So,
but a lot of the reports behind the scenes make clear why it had to happen. There's a lot of reporting there about the players. It just wasn't working. You know, this champion, I mean, and they should have seen it. First time head coach with a win now club. That's not a great combination.
Aren't they just doing a lot of winning? Their good players are having great seasons.
But you're right, but it's against the worst schedule in the NBA statistically. And some of those wins have been really, really close against teams like the Pistons and the horrific Wizards. So it's a lot of dissension, you know, a lot of people. But that's neither here nor there. Sorry, let's Knicks. So, because I think we got to wrap up and start asking ourselves, like, I'm drawing from a lot of what you've brought to the table. Like, why haven't they won a title in the last 50 years? A combination of the overestimation of Patrick Ewing not knowing the help that he could have really used. The savior complex of thinking if you just bring in somebody with the magic formula, you know, in agrarian times, James Dolan would have been the guy to buy the magic beans. I mean, come on. And then the James Dolan's just his putrid, toxic existence. And then the New York impatience with trying to build something from the bottom up. Does that sum it up for you for why they haven't won in 50? Am I missing anything?
No, I think that that's pretty much, those are the big those are really the big culprits.
You know, there's one thing I didn't say that a lot of people would say, and there's a reason why I didn't say it, because as someone who lived through it, I think it's bullshit. It's one man's name. Michael Jeffrey Jordan. People will
no,
say
that is.
I think that's horseshit, but you know people would say that. That Jordan right. blocked Ewing from winning a title. It's
that bullshit. is the super, super lazy. It's like, you know, if you want to give kind of a one word answer, oh, it's because of the most famous player ever. That's the reason. As I had said, I didn't feel, and it also doesn't make any sense. Like, Jordan blocked him. Jordan was on the Chicago Bulls. So having Jordan was better than having Ewing. Okay, so that means that if there was no Jordan, then that means that, like, and that's the thing. If there's no Jordan, if he doesn't exist, I don't see this flowery path for the Knicks. They are one of the teams in the mix before, like, when Jordan couldn't overcome Detroit, the Knicks couldn't overcome Detroit. When yeah. Detroit couldn't overcome Boston, the Knicks couldn't overcome Boston.
I'll say also, crazy insulting to that Portland Trailblazers team to think the Knicks would have rocked them in the finals. That Trailblazers team would have kicked the snot out of the Knicks.
As we said at the beginning, I never felt ever in any year that the Knicks had the most talented team, that they had the team to beat. And I think, you know, when I think about the long-term heartache and distant triumph of being a Knicks fan, the fact that we still look upon John Starks.
Oh my God.
If John Starks hadn't shot 2 for 19, they would have had, that really says volumes to me. Mm. It really does, Dave. Hey, it's true. We know that. And you've spoken very convincingly and eloquently in the past about a bad decision on Riley to not utilize Rolando Blackman when Starks was having a terrible game. That's all true. But again, when you look at all the players who have existed in the NBA orbit and have made impact, a generation of fans, myself included, looking at John Starks means that we were always fighting that incredible uphill battle. It was Isaiah, it was Bird, it was Jordan, it was Olajuwon. And all of those guys were greater superstars than our superstar.
And
the end result makes sense to me. I don't feel as though the squandered, I'm sorry, Dave, I keep cutting off.
No.
The squandered opportunities have been after the Knicks were good. Those Knicks, what the Knicks gave New York and gave Knicks fans for 15 years was fantastic. I'm grateful for it because, they gave us entertaining, competitive basketball against the greatest players and teams ever for a long time and gave us hope that they would could compete on that level and occasionally did. And that really sustained us for a while after that to believe that it could duplicate itself. Once that ended, it was the lack of hope that happened. And, Dolan, of course, being the primary villain. And as we've said, kind of the rotating cast of
saviors,
of incompetent saviors, yeah, is what prevented, as we have said in the past, in a way, they had to get Marbury and Anthony through trades. Because no frontline free agents come to New York. We've talked about that at length. I don't have to launch through that. But that, I think, has been the defining thing. You know, yeah. you have homegrown Tim Duncan in San Antonio, but most other, while the Knicks have been floundering, most other championship teams and championship eras have been defined by acquisitions, by being a destination where a foundation is being built and then a foundational piece or pieces decide to join that. And that's what turns an emerging team into a championship team. Nobody wanted to be that person on New York. Nobody. So it was everywhere else that those things were happening. It was Golden State. It was Miami. It was Cleveland that those things were happening. Nobody was coming to New York. So we had nothing else except our management's bad decisions.
Yeah, and we talked about this, but you brought up something we didn't bring up. I was trying to sum up, but you brought something really important to the table. Like, in the era of player empowerment and free agency, we're not a destination city, even though we're New York frickin' city. And that, to me, I do think is a Jordan legacy thing, because you know all these players want to be Jordan. You know, he's the apple of everybody's eye. But instead of wanting to own the garden by being a Knick, owning the garden meant you go into the garden and conquer. It's such a big deal for LeBron. It was such a big deal for Steph. Remember his rookie year when he went nutso at the garden, they're like 47 or something. It was must for James Harden, who had some amazing games with Houston at the garden. So that culture shift is something we got to get over in a big way. That no, the garden, you conquer the garden by being a Knick, not by traveling there and trashing the team. So I think that's a really important point about that. And I think that's the reason why we're not a destination place too. It's like, I don't want to live in New York. I want to go to New York. Nice place to visit, you know, and that the basketball version of that mentality. The other thing real quick is that when you mentioned John Starks, to me, I love John Starks, and he's symptomatic of the problem of everything we're talking about here. John Starks was a fine player. He is a folk hero in New York, for God's sakes. He sits courtside. People lose their minds for John Stark. John Stark didn't have one-tenth the career of my man who I seem to cape for at every moment, Rolando Blackman. Yet Rolando Blackman could walk into any A&P in New York and get himself some Fruit Loops. John Starks, no, he'd have a different time in the A&P. Where he actually worked before his ascent into the NBA. So John Starks, again, great story, not great player. Power of New York. It makes us all basketball imbalanced. It makes us, I don't want to say not smart, but it makes us imbalanced in how we judge these players. And then we can't ever look at things honestly and build honestly. Now, Thibodeau's a little bit of a different kettle of fish. Partly because he's nuts. He's absolutely out of his mind. So for him, he could be coaching in Peoria right now. He'd be coaching exactly the same way, which I respect about him, even though, and I say this with a worried tone, he does seem to be someone who, you know, he has a shelf life, as it were, in terms of how he relates to players.
I thought he would have exceeded his. Actually, I am. It's been a really pleasant surprise.
Good call. That's right.
That Thibodeau has connected with this team. And the results obviously prove that Tibbs, in his two previous head coaching stops, has won a lot of games. And as you said, has a very, very short, understandably short shelf life. He burns out players. He plays his starters 41 minutes a night, and his hard driving style, every drill, every practice is life and death. You know, that works conceptually or on the high school level, but not in the NBA. And so I actually thought that players would have tuned out Tibbs by now, because that's what happened. They have not. So I actually think that, like, Tibbs' insanity has worn down New York. And now, like, that's kind of part of New York sports. So he might last. He might last a little bit longer. And obviously, we've been saying I like what he's doing with this team. So so I'm not anxious to see him depart just yet. I know we're wrapping up. I was really, really enjoyed talking about this with you. I think it's been very therapeutic, actually, for me.
Right back at you, home
to kind of verbally, and spiritually relive the ghosts of Nick's past. But before we go, one name that I want to bring up is somebody who's not been mentioned yet. And for my Knicks fanhood, he's incredibly important. We have talked about Ewing because, you know, and Ewing being drafted first in 1995, that kind of beginning the Knicks age as we know it. When I became a Knicks fan and became aware of the NBA, I think just a season or two before Ewing was drafted, the Knicks were Bernard King. And it was, so my initiation and kind of, you know, people of my generation as you are, our initiation into, we have talked about the Knicks being chasers, being kind of, you know, we're not the glitziest, we're not the prettiest, but we're going to work harder and hit harder and hit last. And that's, and that's comforting for New Yorkers to think about ourselves in that way. And having Bernard King in a league run by Larry Bird, we were proud to stand behind Bernard. Larry got the MVPs and he got the championships, but there was more dignity to being in New York with Bernard than Boston with Bird. And I stand by that, of course.
Absolutely.
It'll always be that way. But I mentioned that to say Bernard getting hurt puts the Knicks in position to win a possibly, probably tainted lottery and get the number one pick. And I know you remember that couple of years of waiting for Bernard, a repaired bionic Bernard, to team with Ewing. And that falling short of that not happening, but holding on to that dream until it was truly gone, set the tone for me as a Knicks fan and has been kind of a running narrative in the almost 40 years since, making any glimmer of being a competitive team known more for what it's doing on court than for its embarrassing ownership. I just wanted to call out Bernard King as my godfather of the Knicks, what they mean to the city and what they mean to me as a New York basketball fan. Frazier, Willis, DeBuscher and them, that was always history. By the time I knew what the NBA was, those guys were retired.
No.
And they had won two rings in the not-so-distant past at that time.
Mm-hmm. Although it seemed like the distant past to us.
Forever, right? But
it's like ancient history to us. And for me, like, probably my most thrilling basketball moment. You know, our most thrilling watching moments are always as kids. And mine would be Game 5, Pistons-Knicks, where Isaiah scores 16 points in 94 seconds. That's when it was best of five in the series. And let me just say that again in case people didn't hear me. Isaiah scored 16 points in 94 seconds. I once did the math of what that – it's like That'd be like a 530-point game. And Bernard scored 46 and the Knicks won. That was an experience the likes to which I had the cover of that Sports Illustrated taped to my wall. I mean, it just is something real. That's just the most iconic cover in the world. People should look it up. Bernard King Sports Illustrated cover. Not the one with him and Ernie Grunfeld at Tennessee that goes Bernie and Ernie, which I don't know.
Don't look that one up, folks.
Won't look that one up. But that's the rumpus, man. I'm glad you mentioned Bernard King. I actually thought you were going to go down with Charles Oakley, who we didn't mention, but whatever. I mean, the Knicks, it's like when Biggie had that song, Got a Story to Tell, and he talked about a Nick and this sexual imbroglio with a shared femme fatale. And we learned years later that Nick was Anthony Mason. I mean, there's just a lot of Knicks in our cultural bloodstream. That's all I'm saying. And they haven't been good for 50 years, but maybe this year, thanks to a worm named Jalen, the worm will turn.
The heart still beats, Dave, so we have to hope.
Yeah, the heart still beats. The heart still beats. The heart wants what it wants. Woody Allen said that. Now I feel gross. For everybody out there listening, this is Edge of Sports Podcast with The Nation Magazine. He's Arya Shirazi. I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace. Hold on.